You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to On the Power Play with Ben and Colton. I'm your host, Ben Kerr, and with me this week, as always, is my co-host, Colton Prale. Colton, how's it going tonight?
It's wonderful. Wonderful. Alex Burrows out of the lineup for 10 games. I couldn't be happier.
I thought you guys were trying to play Alex Burrows 20 minutes a night for...
Well, yeah, in spirit of the tank, but if I want to watch the Sens games, it helps when they can get away. Oh. This just means more Gabriel Dumont, but we'll get to that later.
All right. Actually, I think that's our first topic, as it's the big story around the NHL as we're recording. 10 games is a pretty significant suspension. Not a lot of double-digit games. I think this is the first one this season with double digits. Mm-hmm. Last year, I think we had one as well. I can't remember who it was, but I remember a significant suspension last year as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it seems like we don't get more than one a year of these really long suspensions. Now, do you feel it's deserved for Alex Burrows? Like, what? Let's go through the play. Like, did he just... To me, I watch it, and he starts going after Taylor Hall, and he just absolutely loses his mind.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I describe this as Bertuzzi-esque. You know, it's not as bad as Bertuzzi, but this could have ended the same way. You know, if in different equipment or if he hits his head against the ice a different way, this could have been disastrous, and I have no issue with Alex Burrows getting 10 game for this. He went ballistic. There is no way to sanction this. It's like the two-handed chop from John Scott. You know, this is, or from Phil Kessel, I should say. He just lost his mind.
Yeah, see, that's what I feel too. I think it's got to be at least 10 games. I wouldn't have had a problem with 20.
No, that was my first thought too. Yeah, you can't allow this.
No, and the guy's down. He's not a threat to you. He's not. It's just malicious in that way. It's. I mean, even the Phil Kessel slash to John Scott, you can kind of say, you know, mm-hmm. John Scott's 6'8", and he's an accomplished fighter in the NHL, and Phil Kessel's never been in a fight in his life, and John Scott's coming after him, and he doesn't know what to do to protect himself, and he loses his mind for that reason. There's no, I don't know how to protect myself here. Taylor Hall is down. He's out. He's in no way a threat to Alex Burrows. There's nothing there for Alex Burrows to say it was self-defense or anything like that. He's gone well past the point of that.
Yeah, his only hope is the Weidman defense, but he would need a concussion for that. You know, and don't get me wrong, Taylor Hall rocked him. You know, I wouldn't be shocked at all if he lost his mind a bit in part as a result of that. But this was just a guy seeing red. And honestly, even before the knee, I would be okay with 5 games. Just you just shouldn't be able to go after a guy, rip him to the ground, and start feeding him knuckle sandwiches into the back of his head when he's still got his gloves on. Like, everyone has their opinion on where fighting belongs in hockey. You know, personally, I don't think it has a place just because of what we've learned about head injuries and seen with guys like Commodore. That said, this wasn't even fighting. This was just blatant assault, and I really don't think there is any other word for what that was other than assault, because Taylor Hall wasn't fighting. You know, this was just Alex Burrows beating on Taylor Hall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and there's no other explanation for it other than, like you said, just losing his mind. And you've got to protect players, and you can't have guys just doing this on a regular basis. You've got to make a statement around the league that such actions are not going to be acceptable, or you're going to get an epidemic of it. And I think we've seen this in the NHL before when they've gone soft on an action, and I'm going to point to the spear to the groin action when they gave Milan Lucic the $2,500 fine for the spear to the groin against Detroit. And then in the playoffs, we saw like four or five guys do it after that because everyone knew you couldn't get suspended because you could point to the first one and be like, it's just a fine. You can't suspend me now. And the league had that precedent hanging over their head. So now you want to make your precedent very harsh and say that such behavior, it's not going to be one or two games. You're going to be sitting for a long time if you do something like this.
Oh, completely, completely. I watched the video, and I rarely watch the videos, so maybe I'm out of line on this. But the language that was used in this explanation video compared to other ones I've watched even just this season was much tougher. It was very to the point that this was not a fight. You know, Taylor Hall was defenseless. This was aggravated. This was vicious. This was unnecessary. It did not beat around the bush in saying that there is no place for this in the game. And that was a refreshing change of pace, if only for this is something that will now be easy to be consistent on.
Yeah, and that's where the NHL needs to go with this. So with Burrows out of the lineup, you mentioned earlier, a little extra ice time for Gabriel Dumont. Is that the way the Senators go, or is there a young kid?
No, it won't be a young kid. Let's throw that out of there right now. It won't be a young kid. It'll be Nate Thompson. It'll be Dumont. You know, Guy Boucher is not a trusting coach. He never has been, probably never will be. It's just not who he is. And as much as I would love him to say, you know what, well, if we don't have our buddy Burrows, we might as well go with Colin White. That's just, it's a dream. It's a pipe dream. He's gonna rely on the players he likes. It's Piatt, it's Dumas, it's Thompson, guys who are useless.
Yeah, I see, and I don't get that because, you know what, the Senators season is done. You guys are looking more and more like you're gonna finish bottom three in the NHL. You know, I thought Montreal might be able to let you guys pass them in the standings, but apparently Ottawa is better at tanking than the Habs are.
We have Magnus Pajärvi on our second line and Piatt as the second C. You just can't compete with that.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen. So I don't understand why guys like White are not getting ice time. Why some of the younger players in Ottawa are not getting ice time. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me why that continues to happen.
Yeah. I'd love to have some great rebuttal for you that, you know, they haven't earned it or they haven't been good, but Max McCormick, Chris DiDomenico, Magnus Pajärvi, Tom Piatt, Alex Burrows, Nate Thompson, all of those players have had better chances than Colin White.
And it's not just Colin White. I mean,
Philip Schlappick.
Yeah, Philip Schlappick, Nick Paul. These are guys 20, 22 years old. I know Nick Paul hasn't had the success that some wanted as one of the pieces in the Jason Spezza deal. But he's 22. There's nothing to lose.
He's no worse than Alex Burrows.
You know, throw him out there. Yeah, he's only got 6 points in 30 NHL games. But throw him out there, see what happens. And you never know what you might find in a player like that. And if he doesn't do anything and you want to leave him in the AHL next year or not qualifying offer or whatever his contract situation is, at least you know, because he's he's 22, and he's reaching almost that age where you need to do something or you're not going to do something in the NHL. You don't see a lot of guys in their late 20s do mm-hmm. too much. So by 22, 23, you need to be into the NHL and as a regular nowadays.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And again, you know, is he going to be that much worse for you than Burrows, who has 8 points in 50-odd games, or Pay-Arvey, who's pointless, or Dumont, who has 2 points in 21 games? You know, is this – is it really the end of the world if he plays, you know? And it's the same for this entire team. Why is Freddie Claesson still getting scratched as a healthy scratch? Why is that a thing? He's 24 and I'd argue third best defenseman on the team.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of things just are not... I don't know, maybe it changes after the trade deadline. Maybe you want to showcase some of these guys to move them in 3 weeks, and then after the trade deadline, your young kids get time. But that's the only reasonable explanation there is, other than an unreasonable expectation, which is I want to keep playing my veterans because I think I'm still in the playoff hunt. That's an unreasonable expectation. I know you're not mathematically eliminated. I get that.
But they're not in the playoff hunt.
But you might as well be. I mean, you might as well be mathematically eliminated. And I'd say the same thing for a number of teams, like the Oilers, like the Canadiens, like the Detroit Red Wings, the Florida Panthers, whoever you want to Buffalo Sabres, whoever you want to point at out there and say, play your kids. You might as well at this point. You're not going anywhere.
No, and either you're tanking for a good pick, which is what I would like to think they're doing. But Boucher did this last year. I mean, he futzed with this even in the playoffs with just very strange depth pairings. He did it in Tampa Bay. This isn't a new symptom of Guy Boucher. You know, he's known to be a line blender and he's known to trust certain players, but this is ridiculous. I mean, we're relying on players like Nate Thompson's who were brought in, and Chris Weidman almost has as many points as Nate Thompson, and he played in 16 games this season and is likely done for the year.
Yeah. And
is a defenseman, you know?
And we talked about Nate Thompson the day he signed. I believe you and I had a good – not on the radio. You weren't on the show then, but we had a good conversation about Nate Thompson. I remember you just being very confused, let's say, by what the Senators were trying to accomplish with that signing. And what the direction of that signing meant for the team and for the veterans, because – I mean, Nate Thompson just is not very good.
No, he is not very good. He's not very young. And he's not very movable because they gave him a no trade clause. So, this is the exasperated fan side of me that's coming out. But what was the point of that? You know, you're literally just filling a roster spot and making it tougher for your good young players, which you suddenly have, you know, a decent amount of. You're stopping them from playing. And I understand maybe you don't want to rush a Logan Brown, or maybe you don't want to rush a Chlapik, but at least give them an opportunity. You know, well, let them fight for that spot.
To me, Logan Brown, I think, has been handled correctly. I'll say this one. I was very down on Logan Brown in the summer when Nate Thompson signed. And I thought he had a very bad year, even though they won the Memorial Cup with Windsor last year. I thought he really disappointed as a prospect for where he was drafted. I know he had the wrist injury. He had some other contributing factors to that. But I felt like Logan Brown needed to go back to junior. Almost no matter what he did early in the season and what he did in camp, he should not have been in the NHL. He wasn't. He didn't dominate juniors in a way that showed that he had nothing more to learn down there. And I always felt it was better for him to play 20 minutes on a junior team than to play 8 minutes in Ottawa.
That's fair.
And stagnate. So Logan Brown's one issue, but as I said, with a guy like Nick Paul, he's 22. A guy like Chlapik, he may have some AHL learning to do. Okay, but he spent half the year in the AHL, and he's one of those guys. It's a different situation when you've got an AHL-aged player because they can go up and down. because if you have him up for some time and he's getting Burrow's minutes now and Burrow's comes back, then he goes back down and it you don't have him out of the lineup. You don't have him sitting and just doing where as with a Logan Brown, with the way the transfer rules are, you have to keep him up. And so you've got to either be playing him or not. So I can understand that. But yeah, with Colin White, with Schlappick,
even a Gabriel Gagne.
Yes. Even a Gabriel Gagne, has he even gotten an NHL game?
Nope.
So yeah, one of your better players in the AHL, and just not giving him any NHL time or experience. And I liked Gabriel Gagne a lot in his draft year. And I know his post-draft year wasn't what people wanted, very similar to a later round version of, but similar to what Logan Brown did.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, maybe he needed some time. Sometimes those big bodies do. Like Brown and Gagne. But now's the time to see if he's at least got something, even if it's a 5-game call-up, even if it's a 10-game call-up. That's something the Leafs did in the year that they ended up landing Austin Matthews with first overall was, you know, Connor Brown got 10 games and William Nylander got 20 games and a bunch of guys got games for that team down the stretch because they wanted to expose them to the NHL. And it was like a rotating crew from like January on who got games for that team. And I think it's benefiting their group right now.
Well, that's just it. And at the very least, you get a better idea of what players you like and what players can contribute. And you know what you've got in certain players, whether or not you're going to use them. You know what you've got in a Josh Levo. And in a situation like this year, you can look at moving him when he requests the trade like he did. You know, at the moment, if Gabriel Gagne requests a trade, does Ottawa management really know what they've got in that player? I'd be pretty hesitant to say yes, especially with the way the Belleville Sens have been run so far. You know, it just doesn't strike me from top down as an organization that really understands their prospects. And that is a fairly massive indictment, but with the way they've been managed so far, you know, exception being Logan Brown, who I agree with, he's been handled fairly well. I just don't get it, you know. Even a guy like Thomas Chabot, he has proven he can play in the NHL. Why wasn't he given a McAvoy-esque role? You know, why was he limited to 11, 12, 13 minutes a night when you tried out guys who are clearly inferior for longer periods of time just because they're more experienced? And even Erik Karlsson came out and said that publicly, you know, that he didn't understand why certain young players weren't getting the time that they should be, you know. And when your captain is coming out against your coaching and against your management, and that captain is Erik Karlsson, who is the best defender in the world, in my opinion, you know, changes need to be made, but somewhere in the organization, because you can't have players of that caliber and that quality publicly coming out against your coaching and expect that to last and expect good things to happen.
Yeah, it is what it is at this point.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
There's an indictment of what's gone on in Ottawa this season. There's a lot of mistakes that I see being made, and I see a lot of parallels sadly, in what my team's doing as well.
Mm-hmm.
At times, I do like that Montreal brought up Nikita Sherbak and is giving him a chance here at the end of the year. Yeah, there's some questionable things that are going on with their moves, with the idea of character and grit over skill right now. And I think that's an idea that's dominating both organizations, and it's to their detriment.
It's really interesting. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, and I'm kind of springing you on this, but Travis Yost wrote a piece, I want to say yesterday, about the death of heavy hockey. And it was a fantastic piece.
saw the headline and I bookmarked it, but I haven't read it.
Fantastic, fantastic piece. One of the things he points out is that, you know, and it's something I've looked into as well in the past, is there's no real correlation between hitting and winning. It's been up, it's been down, it's been up, it's been down. This year, however, there is a massive, keep this in mind, it's all in context, but a massive correlation between hitting and winning, somewhere along the lines of the same correlation that Corsi has, very similar this season, which is shockingly different from years past. What we've also seen is hitting drop drastically, 16, almost 17% from its high in 2014-15, I believe, and about 9% over the past couple years. It's quickly falling, so teams are getting away from hitting, and the teams that are hitting more are losing more frequently. And I think the only two teams in the top 10 for hits per game that were in the playoffs were Washington and Boston, both of whom, while they hit a lot, are very dominant puck possession teams. But it was interesting to see how clearly the NHL is getting away from this. And we all saw it. You know, he mentions it in his article as well. You know, the Kings teams and the Bruins team of 2010, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. You're not getting beaten down in the same way. You know, you play the Ducks, and even Anaheim isn't as big and heavy as it is. You know, guys like Clayton Stoner don't really have a place in that team anymore because of guys like Hampus Lindholm and Josh Manson, who are, you know, especially a Josh Manson, who's filling that defensive blue liner role, but in a totally different way. And that's the way the NHL is moving. And when we see teams like Montreal, like Ottawa, like Edmonton, relying on these big, gritty players who are slow and who are frequently last to the puck or out of position because they went for a hit, it's just very confusing to me. You know, it's your job as a general manager is to make trades, but also to watch trends, to have an idea of where the league is going and build your team accordingly. And it just strikes me that these teams are actively building in the wrong direction and show no signs of slowing.
Yeah, and that's a frustrating thing for our being a fan, is to see where the league is going and to see your teams not going towards that.
Mm-hmm. It's just maddening. And I pity Oilers fans. I really, really do, because there's just so many players that fit that mold on their team. We've kind of got a little off topic here, so why don't we circle back, close out the Burrows, and then move on. 10 games, I'm definitely in favor. You mentioned a possibility of 20. I would have been okay with that, but do you think it would have been over the top?
I don't think it would have in this case. I think it's such a play that we don't see in the NHL anymore, that we haven't seen since maybe the early 90s or even the mid 80s. This type of a vicious assault from one player to another, we just don't see anymore, and the league wants to discourage as part of the game.
I'm fine with that answer, and I think I agree. You know, I bring it back to that first description I saw, or I had when I saw the attack, was Bertuzzi-esque. You know, he just jumped them, and I'd be fine with 20 games as well. Why don't we transition though? Marc-Andre Fleury makes his return to the Steel City, Pittsburgh Penguins, welcoming back Fleury. I watched the video tonight. I didn't have a chance to see the game in person. I have to admit, I got a little choked up. That was pretty neat, especially seeing the fans' reactions. There was one girl like wiping a tear away. It was pretty cool. I not a Pens fan by any mean, but I thought that was really, really cool, the tribute they made for him.
The video was very well done. You can't argue with that. Very good production quality and editing and putting it together. Showcasing his career in Pittsburgh, his biggest moments, obviously the cup wins, but what he meant to that team, both on the ice and off the ice, I think was captured in that video. And as much as Fleury meant on the ice to that Penguins team, I think we've seen in the 24/7 series, mm-hmm. And in other instances of getting a glimpse behind the scenes of the Penguins, that his sense of humor, His ability to keep things light in the room, his ability to remove tension from that team was very important to the Penguins and to their success over the last 10 years or so. And that's something that is not easy to replace.
No, and I think anybody who knows that team or who's followed even just Fleury's career individually has seen that side of him just through stories that have been shared in the media, whether it's other players or you know, reporters. If you haven't read it yet, the 31 Thoughts, Elliot Friedman tells the story of the time he snuck out of a year-end party to hide a dead fish in Ray Whitney's car, and took Whitney about a week to find out. Ryan Whitney, you're right. Excuse me. Took Whitney about a week to find out where that stench was coming from. It's just like, that's just such a fun story. It's a harmless, for the most part, prank, but it's those kind of moments that made him who he was and make him such a lovable player. And I don't want to say we underrate him for that, but it has had times, I think, cast a bit of a shadow over how solid he's been for Pittsburgh. There were some rough years in the middle there for sure, but you know, he is among their franchise, if not the franchise leader, in just about every statistical category for goaltenders for that team. You know, he has been phenomenal for them, and I think he got the tribute he deserved. I'm curious to see, and I'm curious to get your opinion on what happens when he retires. Do you think that jersey hangs in the rafters?
I think it does in Pittsburgh.
I think it has to. Three cups, most games played, most wins. And he's got most shutouts too. You know, he's done a lot for that franchise.
Yeah, former first overall pick, mm-hmm. and it came in when that franchise was a laughing stock. When he came into that team and started playing for them, they were a joke in the NHL. I don't know how many people remember how bad the Penguins of the early 2000s were. But they were every bit as bad as last year's Colorado Avalanche.
We're talking about a team that was almost traded, almost moved.
Yeah, almost moved, had no fan support, was, you know, filing for bankruptcy protections. That team was in real dire straits when Marc-Andre Fleury came in. I know Sidney Crosby gets most of the credit for bringing them back, but no one man does things on their own. And I think Crosby and Malkin and Fleury and Sergei Gonchar and a lot of players need to get some credit for what happened in Pittsburgh and the turnaround that franchise had.
I completely agree. Completely agree with you. It'll be interesting to see what happens as those players retire. Because you're not going to get another Malkin, another Crosby. And, you know, Pittsburgh is a fairly storied franchise. I'm curious to see how many jerseys from this era we see hanging in the rafters in 2-3 decades' time. I think it's a handful.
I think it's at least three.
Yeah.
Right off the top of my head, with Fleury, Crosby, and Malkin.
Yep.
I think you can make the argument for Chris Kunitz.
I think Chris Letang, depending on how his career ends, has another argument as well.
Yeah, and then you see where you go from there. I know I don't know that anybody else really stands out besides those names. Gonchar maybe, but not quite enough years in Pittsburgh, was a big part of turning their team around, but I don't know if he has long enough in Pittsburgh.
He's an honorable mention for me.
Yeah, and Jordan Staal, I'd say no.
No, he's done too much elsewhere.
Yeah, but I think that those three or four big names go. Maybe Matt Murray by the time he's done.
Yeah.
He might be a candidate because I know he's had a rough season, but I still think he's a fantastic goalie and is going to be one of the best goalies in the NHL.
I am firmly on board that train with you. He has been outstanding. You want to move to a different fantastic goalie?
Sure.
Al Montoya. You watched the interview after the Ryan Rashog saga on Twitter?
Oh, yes. And Montoya handled that perfectly, I felt. I don't think he could have done a better job He didn't acknowledge him by name. He didn't answer his question. And he didn't acknowledge the controversy in any way, but everyone who knew what it was about. It was an almost perfect reaction on his just refusal to answer Ryan Rashog's question and move on to another question.
I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I feel like I have a unique perspective on this as someone working in the industry who's been in Ryan's shoes and who understands to a degree what it is he's going through. And I've been there on a number of different scenarios. And I think that's what it is. You know, there's two ways you can handle this. And I'll share a personal anecdote to kind of give an explanation. I was covering the World Cup of Baseball, under 18 World Cup of Baseball. It's the equivalent of the World Juniors. It is massive in Japan. Every night it was the most watched show. Sportsnet was down there. We were doing our best to cover it at the TV station I was at when it occurred this past year. One of the players I interviewed was a fantastic Japanese player. They've called him their Babe Ruth. He's set all of the high school records. 18-year-old, he's going to be a stud. He's just one of those players that you've got pegged early on. Think of Connor McDavid, and that's a very fair comparison to who this player is. And it was the first game of the tournament, and he'd had two or three home runs, I believe, in the game. And we went to go interview him, and it turned out he'd left. And, you know, you're stuck saying, what do you do? You know, how do you do a story on a game like this where that guy's missing? What are your options? You know, he's the guy you have to talk to. And this is post-game, mind you. So it's not exactly the same as Ryan's, but it's almost more difficult in a post-game scenario because there's less you can play with. So what we ended up doing was we ended up talking to a bunch of different players who were there, who got to watch it and say, tell me about him. You know, tell me about this player, about being a part of this moment. And it's no different than some of the pieces Sportsnet did during Matthews' 4-goal debut, you know, or was it Gagne's 10-point night? Or was it 8-point night? Regardless.
Yeah.
You know, it's about sharing the moment and reliving the moment, even if you can't get that one player's voice. You find a way to work around it because that is your job. You know, and I understand wanting to get the backup goalie starting before his game. You know, that's great. It's a good storyline. But it's not like it's something new. There are a bunch of players around the league who won't talk pre-game on game day. They'll talk to you after, but they won't do it before. And that's, you know, that's their preparation. That's fine. It's not something we should crucify the players for. You just need to find a different way to tell your story. And if you want to tell the Montoya story, tell it after the game. Tell it when he'll talk to you. Don't lambaste him on Twitter because he wouldn't talk to you and give you a pointless 30-second soundbite. You know, it's not like he was the only way to tell that story, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. I mean, so many players give the same cliched canned answers all the time, and the reporters have to work around it, and you have to work your story with that quote. You can work a Montoya story without a quote from Montoya because it doesn't add anything at this point for him to say, you know, we're facing a tough team tonight. You know, I got to be prepared to go in when coach calls my number. I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get support from my teammates. We all got a button to buckle down because they have a good offense and they have some talented players. And then and you know, I can say what he's going to tell you. And so why does that need to be in the story? If you want to be, you know, this is his first start as an Oiler. He's played two games before this in a relief capacity and done pretty well. But tonight's his first start since getting traded here. And it's his first opportunity in an Edmonton net. You can certainly put out that story without quotes from him. And I get the frustration, but just the attack on him on Twitter is just where it's not necessary.
That's just it. You can be frustrated. You can be angry. You be angry in the office. You don't take it online. You don't put it on Twitter. There's no need for that. You wonder why players won't talk to you. It's because of those reasons. That's why you get canned answers. It's so frustrating.
Exactly. And that's why it gives anybody who's trying to interview these guys a bad name and a bad rap.
Mm-hmm. If they are scared of getting lambasted over what they say, they're not going to say anything. They're going to pull a Marshawn Lynch and say, I don't want to get fined.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's the problem with the story, with the way Ryan Rashog handled it. I mean, I don't want to get on Rashog too bad. I mean, I think generally he does a pretty good job.
Yep.
With his reports out of Edmonton. We know he's often the first on anything Oilers related in terms of trade news or a free agent signing or anything like that. He clearly has worked hard to get sources in the organization and to get that news out. And he generally handles himself in a pretty professional manner. But this was one time where he clearly didn't, and we all make mistakes. It's something that I think that all media should keep in mind when they're dealing with something like this. I don't want to get on him too much and just kind of make it a story as of what we all can't do when we have our press credentials and when we're at a site is mm-hmm. get the story, find a way to get it with the people who will talk to you, or still do your story on what you observe without the, you know, the interview there or the soundbite, because I think it can be done. If you can work with a soundbite where everyone's heard it 1,000 times, you can work without that soundbite.
That's very well said. And I think it's fair to give Rashog a commendation of how he handled it afterwards. The apology, even just going to the presser afterwards and talking to Montoya, or at least attempting to, you know, personally, he probably should have apologized before that started, but, you know, we don't know if he did or if he didn't. But at least going there, apologizing afterwards, you know, that part is commendable.
Yeah, and that shows some good professionalism and a good sign on his part.
Sticking with good professionalism, Mike Fisher returning.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation in Ottawa. I think it's a good addition for – or sorry, not in Ottawa. I'm so used to Mike Fisher being an Ottawa Senator. But
I wish.
That's a good situation in Nashville. He's back with the team. Obviously, no longer captain. They're not going to switch things up and pull that off Roman Josi. But I've always said the C on a jersey is more ceremonial than anything else.
Yeah.
Leaders lead with whether they have a letter or not, and you're not going to turn a non-leader into a leader just by stitching in an extra half inch or 3 inches of a fabric to their jersey. So I think it's a good leadership move for the Predators, but more importantly on the ice. 1 through 4, I'm not sure there's any better center line in the NHL than what the Nashville Predators are now putting out there. And along with their 1 through 4 best defense in the league, I think you have to consider them a very serious threat for the Stanley Cup. I mean, they have Johansson, Turris, Bonino, and Mike Fisher down the middle. And then on the wings, guys who can fill in case of injury. We've seen Cal Jarnrock.
Austin Watson.
Austin Watson come in. Colton Sissons come in and play center for them in the past. So their center depth is really, really strong.
It's fantastic. Hey, you look at this Nashville team and the changes that have been made in just the last 3-4 seasons, that's how you build a team. There's just fantastic work and an excellent use of prospects to acquire better players. from David Poyle. So really commendable there. But no, I completely agree. If you can get Mike Fisher in a situation like this, and look, it's not Mike Fisher. I've played 82 games and I'm in top peak condition, but it's a free center who you didn't have to give anything up for and who you know how he plays and is in still at least in decent shape and is healthy. And by the time the playoffs come around, we'll be ready for them. I don't know why you don't make this move. And I'm curious to see if anybody else looks at making similar moves in the future.
Oh, you've gotten him as a fourth line center, like I said. You can't go wrong with that. He was your second line center last year, and you went to the Cup final.
That's just it. I mean, this is just outstanding business, and it frustrates me because the Nashville Predators don't need another good center, you know? They've got him.
How are you going to feel in 2 weeks when the Nashville Predators acquire one of Rick Nash, Max Pacioretty, Mike Hoffman, Evander Kane, maybe not Evander Kane because I don't see that.
I hope it's Mike Hoffman.
How are you going to feel when they fill that role? Because I think that's the big piece they're missing right now is the top six winger.
Yeah.
And I think that David Poyle has kept his powder dry, so to speak, with this Fisher signing. He's addressed a need on his team with the Fisher signing and still kept his cache of prospects and draft picks. I know he's moved some to get Kyle Turris, but he's still got plenty more picks and prospects that he can push to go all in on this. And I see the Predators as being a landing spot for that big winger. And there's other names that I know Bob McKenzie mentioned this week, they may look at a Thomas Tatar or a Gustav Nyquist as someone they can have under team control for longer than just a rental piece. And that makes me think of, again, Pacioretty and Hoffman, if they're looking for multiple years, as opposed to, say, Rick Nash or Evander Kane.
Yeah, and I would start with the Pacioretty's and the Hoffmans because you're a team that's going to be contending for multiple years, so you might as well try and get that control. I would stay far away from Rick Nash. Just the asking price alone, I think, is outlandish and ridiculous. But I also don't think the player you're getting back in return is as good as a Pacioretty or a Hoffman or even an Evander Kane. At one point in time, he was. He's still solid-ish, but he would not be my first choice. And I don't think he really fits their team as well. You know, this is a young, fast, skilled team. And Rick Nash, I think, just slows that pace down a bit.
Yeah, and I think it would be interesting to see Max Pacioretty and PK Subban on the same team again, given all that came out. And all the conspiracy theories. I'm not even sure if they're true or not. But there's a lot of conspiracy theories about Pacioretty and Subban not having a good relationship and that being a reason for the trade. I'd love to see him in Nashville just to prove those conspiracy theories wrong. And once again, to show how stupid Mark Bergevin was to make the first trade.
Yeah.
And so that, to me, would be something that I would personally like to see because anything that continues to show Mark Bergevin's incompetence to the world is hopefully one step closer to getting him fired.
Only in your own little dream world. No, I mean Pacioretty I think would be a solid fit. I honestly like Mike Hoffman a little better on this team just for the added speed he brings. And I think he would be a better fit for the Western Conference. He's a little bigger, a little stronger.
Another year of control.
Yeah. I just think the year of control really helps, especially for Nashville when you're looking to go deep. But I think just as a player style wise, I think Pacioretty is probably better suited to the East, than he is the West.
I think you've also got an advantage in Hoffman in some familiarity and in chemistry with Kyle Turris.
Yep. Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, you can slot him in right now in the place of like a Smith or you know, Yarncroak, and you're right there, you know?
Yeah, and like he's already, you know, been on Turris's wing in the past.
And so, I mean, in both of Pacioretty and Hoffman, you're getting someone who's used to playing with an extremely dynamic defenseman. And I think that's really underrated. You know, we talk all the time about, you know, finding guys who could play with Sidney Crosby and who could, you know, do the dirty work so that he can find them or know where he's going to be. I think it's an underrated skill set to be able to play with a dynamic defenseman, to be able to know when you've got to cover for them, but also to be able to know when you've got to fly the zone and just trust that they're going to be one of the best in the world at what they do.
Yeah, and the number of first assists, I think people have given Pacioretty a lot of flack. His goals are a little bit down. He went on that hot streak and they're not as far down as they were. But they're still a little bit down from the past few years. One of the things that one of the interesting articles I've read, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was probably a couple months ago, is just the number of first assists that either PK Subban or Andre Markov had on Max Pacioretty goals. The number of times that they were the last person to touch the puck before Pacioretty on his goals, and the number of long passes for two-on-ones, for breakaways, for three-on-twos that he ended up coming down the wing and sniping off of was a big percentage, a good 30-40% of his goals. And those numbers just aren't there this year with Montreal's defense. And I think that that's a big reason why his goal total is down. He's not getting the puck in transition the way he was accustomed to with a defense that had Subban. And even last year, Markov made up for it quite a bit, and he scored his normal number of goals. But now there's just nothing back there.
That's just it.
Not the puck. He scores goals and he gets his points, but he's not the 5-on-5 point generator that those two guys were.
Shea Weber isn't quarterbacking your breakout, is what I was trying to say. You know, he doesn't have the same dynamic passing ability that a Markov or a Subban had. And I mean, it's no different than the way we've seen Ovechkin not struggle, but take a step back when he's not playing besides a Nick Backstrom or a, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on his name. Evgeny Kuznetsov. Thank you. I had his first name in my head. You know, it's no different than taking Ovechkin away from those two players and watching each flounder without the other. When you take away a scorer from a playmaker or a playmaker from their scorer, you know, it's just harder. You're asking more of them. They have to come deeper to create. Just look at how much better Taylor Hall's doing now that he's in New Jersey, you know, and he's surrounded by people who can actually get him the puck. Not necessarily great people, but better people who can get him the puck. It's just a matter of getting help and being able to be in the spot to succeed the most and not having to do two person's jobs.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And there's a synergy created by the number of really strong players that you have online. And I think that those, we talked about Pacioretty a bit on last week's show, and we talked about how he's been able to generate without an elite center, how he's done his best work with Desharnais and Deneau at center. And part of that was the number of passes that he got from the defense. The playmaking came from the blue line at times instead of coming from the center ice position.
That's just it. You know, it's when these guys have to go to their own blue line to create, they can't be in a position for the outlet pass. They can't be in a position to receive at center and turn a dime and go. You know, it's exactly it. They can't be where they need to be if they're picking up the puck.
Yeah, that's there's always a role for all five guys on the ice, and if one guy can't do his role, it brings down the other four.
Completely agree. You want to wrap this up with our good friend Mike Zigomanis?
Yes. some word out of the Ontario Court of Appeal today that came down. Mike Zigomanis has won his lawsuit against a energy drink company owned by Frank D'Angelo. It was the famous Cheetah Power Surge energy drink that Ben Johnson once promoted. They had a deal with Mike Zigomanis in May 2011 when Zigomanis was playing for the Leafs, paying him $50,000 a year to pitch this energy drink. And I think one of the main reasons that they picked him was because he was on the Leafs, and they're a small company in the beverage industry, certainly, mainly working in Ontario and in Canada, and trying to push this drink. And so a Leaf player would be quite the coup for them. Anyways, Zigomanis went through his career, got sent down to the Marlies the next year, and at the same time as he was sent down to the Marlies, an ex-girlfriend posted some nude pictures of Zigomanis that he had taken on and sent to her, posted them on one of those revenge porn sites. And so Frank D'Angelo and D'Angelo Brands company tried to use a morals clause to say that he had violated the morals clause, that he had done something that was shocking to the community, and so that they could get out of this advertising deal, which was for 4 years, without paying him the final 3 years. And I think the judge at the district or superior court level and the Court of Appeal has seen through this, said, you know, it's not that shocking to the public for a hockey player's nude pictures to end up on the internet. And it's not of any fault of his own that he was the victim here. So he's not doing something that's shocking to public consciousness. And as well, the pictures were taken before he signed the contract, so he can't be blamed for anything he did before signing the contract. So they've given him the full amount of his endorsement deal. What do you think about Mike Zigomanis being in the news, Colton?
Takeaways: Mike Zigomanis has nudes on the internet. That's the big one for me. I was unaware of this. Happily unaware of this. I don't think I'm going to search them out. But, you know, the more you know.
The more you know. And we also learned that Frank D'Angelo is a bit of a shady businessman, but I don't
yeah.
think that's a revelation to...
No, I don't think so. If you've seen any of the Cheetah ads or know anything about that business, it's a little weird. You know, just it's a little off.
The whole Ben Johnson thing.
Was... Oh my gosh, yeah. It just didn't go well. But I'm happy for Zigomanis because, you know, he doesn't have to pay his legal fees. He gets to keep his money. That's a lot of money for a guy who played, you know, who really didn't get a ton of NHL time. So, you know, good for him. Happy for him. Sad that this has come back up because, you know, these nudes are going to go and get resurfaced to touch in the hockey community, which is sad. No one should have to go through that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a what was it with that Leafs team? There was Yuri Talusti.
They were sending them to each other.
Yeah, he had some pictures of Yuri Talusti ended up on the internet, and there weren't nudes, but there were some weird pictures of Grabowski and a pineapple.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know if you ever saw those. Those were a little off as well.
You know what I think it was? Like 2008, 2009 was just early enough that, you know, like social media was really only just kicking off. You know, I think Twitter went public in 07, or no, Facebook was 07, Twitter was 05, you know, Reddit didn't really exist, there was no Instagram, you know, we didn't really have the same networking capabilities that we do today. So there was still like an aspect of privacy, you know, there was the fear that you could get hacked and your pictures could be posted on the internet, but it wasn't like it is now. You were going to get doxxed if your pictures were on the internet. People weren't going to, you know, find you, hunt you down, and spam you with these pictures. It was just risque enough, you know? Now it's terrifying. that's my gut. I think there's probably more out there that we're lucky to have not seen.
So Colton, who would be the most horrifying naked NHL pictures that you can think of?
Oh, great question. I'm going Dustin Byfuglien as he drops Evander Kane's clothes into the shower because I think he would just look so angry.
Well, I was going to go with the Brent Burns, but we've already seen the Brent Burns nude photographs.
Yeah, Brent Burns has fun tattoos, though. You know, like I'm okay with those. The Joe Thornton and Brent Burns face off was a little weird, but the beard's made up for it.
Yeah. So we and Joe Thornton, I mean, that beard that was so dead and straggly.
Oh my gosh. You know what I want? I want a really tasteful Matt Zuccarello one. He's so tiny.
That just goes back to your love for your co-managing editor, Nick Hendrickson.
It's true. I just like dwarves.
I think that may be it. I personally, for me, I think the scariest one would be Zdeno Chara.
He did body issue years back.
I know he's done the body.
He's terrifying.
But Zdeno Chara is just terrifying. He's just so big and so just,
yeah,
some of his proportions, it doesn't look human.
Yeah.
And so that would be the most terrifying nude NHL player that I could think of.
I just wouldn't want to have to explain that, you know, like look at that and then be like, you know, well, I'm sure there are good qualities about myself, you know. Man is just a physical specimen.
All right, well, that should wrap up today's show. What do we have on the website that's worth reading right now, Colton?
Rumors. We are killing the rumors game recently. Armand just put up his article, and quite a big fan of it. We had another one go out yesterday. If you are looking for trade deadline news, if you're looking to see who is going to be leaving your team anytime soon, I highly suggest you go check out our rumors. We are posting them almost every day, so go check those out.
Yeah, I think our plan, or my plan, is to try and get them out every day until the deadline. If that means I have to write them myself, I'm writing them myself. I did two articles on that this week, but we've got Armand's out today. I know Dan Mount has one coming our way tomorrow.
Yep.
And then I will see if someone signs up for Friday. If not, I will put out my own on Friday. Yeah. I've also got the February draft rankings are out. We've done up to number 25. So those are out. Likely Friday, again, you'll see numbers 26 to 31. And then our honorable mentions, guys who are just on the cusp of first round status, will likely come out over the weekend. And that will clear up our draft rankings for February and be our final ranking until we do the big one at the start of April. So keep a lookout for that as well.
I'm just scrolling through them now. Who is your favorite in the 21 to 25 range? Obviously, I mean, you've got them ranked numerically. Which one of these guys do you have the most love for? Is it Olofsson?
Yeah, I think Olofsson right now, it was hard to keep him out of the top 20. There's a couple of players that are very similar, and I'm sure I will have a better differentiation of them when I see more games. But at this point, there hasn't been that many European games. We've got the Five Nations coming up in the next couple weeks, and then we've got the under-18s, so that will give me a lot more to watch on these players. But you've got Kotkaniemi, you've got Lundstrom, and you've got Olofsson, all there, all playing center, all in and around that that 15 to 21 range, and just ahead of them, Rasmus Kupari. And I just want to see a little bit more of all of those guys. A winger from Russia who I want to see a little bit more of is Denisov, and he'll be in our next batch. But, I mean, I have them where I have them now based on what I've seen, but they're certainly not locked in for their final ranks because, as I say in the preamble, just have not seen enough of the Europeans yet, and that's a typical thing that happens in my draft rankings every year is you get a lot more video of the European players later in the season than you do early in the year.
There we go. Look for Dominic Bach to go first overall. You heard it here first. That's what Ben's saying.
I don't know if that's what I said.
Well,
I think Dominic Bach being a first rounder would be quite the story. I mean, we've already seen one player out of Germany go third overall, but another first rounder out of Germany would start to have people banging the drum as Germany as, you know, a top eight or nine a hockey country in the world.
Story for a different time for sure, but we'll talk about that maybe next time because I'm excited about the future of German hockey. That's a cast all in itself.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me again. Thanks for all our listeners. I hope you guys have a good night or a good afternoon if you're listening to this in the afternoon.
No matter where you are, enjoy it.
You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.